Hello there. Today is Monday, December 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, violent weekend attacks targeting Jews celebrating Hanukkah and Christians attending church services.
We just ask for your thoughts and prayers for our community and the parishioners of the West Freeway Church of Christ.
Standoff over how to conduct a Senate impeachment trial continues. Also ahead, a beloved U.S. civil rights icon announces a very serious health diagnosis. It's all on today's International Edition. A knife-wielding man stormed into a rabbi's home and stabbed five people in the Orthodox Jewish community north of New York City, or in an Orthodox Jewish community north of New York. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
It happened during a Hanukkah celebration Saturday night in Muncie. Police say the suspect, Grafton Thomas, faces five counts of attempted murder. Joseph Gluck witnessed the attack.
He took out his knife sword from a holder and started hitting people back and forth. He didn't say anything.
Gluck chased Thomas into the street and was able to get his license plate number. That led police to capture him in New York City. This attack comes on the heels of a string of attacks targeting Jews not just in the state but in the country.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo called it a cancer fueled by growing intolerance and hatred in America and said the actions are clearly an act of domestic terrorism.
It is domestic terrorism. These are people who intend to create mass harm, mass violence, generate fear based on race, color, creed. That is the definition of terrorism.
Police tracked a fleeing suspect to Manhattan and made an arrest within 2 hours of the attack Saturday night. Officials say the suspect, Grafton E. Thomas, had blood all over his clothing, smelled of bleach, but said almost nothing when officers stopped him. There had been a string of about nine anti-Semitic attacks in recent weeks in New York. Meanwhile, in Texas over the weekend, two people have died after a gunman opened fire in a church in the town of White Settlement. Police Chief J.P. Bevering, in a brief news conference, assured the public there is no longer a threat.
The preliminary reports indicated that the man entered the church and fired a weapon. A couple of members of the church returned fire, striking the suspect who died at the scene.
In a live stream of the church service, the gunman can be seen getting up from a pew and walking to someone at the back of the church before pulling out a gun and opening fire. Authorities are releasing few details about the suspect or what may have been a motive. A tweet. A tweet from U.S. President Donald Trump that identified an intelligence analyst as the alleged whistleblower who helped spark his impeachment was temporarily blocked over the weekend, with Twitter blaming an outage that affected a number of user accounts. In recent days, Trump shared an unsubstantiated media report and a second post that appeared to name the intelligence community member. Democrats, some Republicans, and members of the U.S. intelligence community have strongly objected to the effort to reveal the whistleblower's identity, calling it inappropriate and possibly illegal. Joining us to talk more about it and the standoff in the impeachment trial, or over the impeachment trial, is attorney Joel Paul. He's a professor at UC Hastings Law School. Thank you for being with us. If this is, in fact, the whistleblower that sparked the impeachment, is it, in fact, illegal?
If, in fact, the person who the president has named is the whistleblower, it would be a very serious violation of the Whistleblower Act. Moreover, even if it isn't the whistleblower, or if it is the whistleblower, the president's actions would seem to be intended to intimidate witnesses and to prevent other whistleblowers from coming forward. And so I think this potentially could constitute another impeachable crime, which the president could be impeached for subsequently.
The whole point of this whole whistleblower protection is that allows people to come forward when they see something they believe is wrongdoing by elected officials. Is that correct?
The Whistleblower Act is a really important reform. It was largely promoted by a bipartisan act promoted by Senator Grassley and by Senator McCaskill. The whistleblower law is really sort of fundamental, I think, to preventing corruption and preventing illegal acts within the government. It's a way in which we hold our elected officials accountable for their actions. And if whistleblowers are not going to be protected, if their anonymity is exposed, if they're subject to potentially reprisals by people who disagree with them, this will seriously undermine our ability in a democracy to hold accountable our elected officials.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the current impeachment trial that we are expecting in the Senate. It appears at this point that there's somewhat of a standoff with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi not willing to send over the articles of impeachment to the Senate so that they can begin the trial because she is not convinced that it will be an actual trial, an actual fair trial. Mitch McConnell has so far not changed his viewpoint that we heard when he said that basically he's looking to see a quick acquittal and he's working in close connection with the president and his attorneys.
Right. The disagreement really comes down to whether or not there will be witnesses and evidence that can be introduced in the trial. Leader McConnell has said that they would not vote on whether to have witnesses and what witnesses could be admitted until after the arguments are presented by House leaders and by the president's attorneys. And of course, given that McConnell controls the majority of senators in the Senate, that suggests that the Democrats would not have an opportunity to present witnesses. And I wonder what kind of a trial that would be with no witnesses and no evidence. It's not at all unusual, by the way, when a prosecutor gets an indictment from a grand jury to decide not to present the indictment for trial if, for instance, the prosecutor feels he doesn't have the witnesses or the evidence to convince a jury. And in this instance, that's the position that Nancy Pelosi and the House managers find themselves in. If they're not going to be allowed to present witnesses and evidence, and if Leader McConnell says the fix is already in, then there really is no reason for them to present the articles of impeachment and to go forward with the trial.
What about the argument from Republicans that the Democrats said they were in a hurry to get this done so that, you know, it would not sort of bleed into the upcoming presidential election with primaries just around the corner? So they're arguing that, you know, first the Democrats said they want this to be speedy and now they've put it at a complete standstill.
Well, it's a funny argument, of course, for the Republicans to be making, because clearly they're not interested in a conviction. They're interested in a quick acquittal. The Democrats aren't interested in a quick acquittal. They're interested in a fair trial. So I think that that argument is not really very persuasive. And it may be that there will never be a trial, and the voters will ultimately have the opportunity to decide in the next election whether or not an impeached president should be reelected. And, you know, that seems to me to be a pretty fair outcome to leave it to the voters.
All right. That is Attorney Joel Paul. He's a professor at UC Hastings Law School. Thank you so much for being with us. U.S. Representative John Lewis, who has served more than three decades in Congress, has announced he has cancer. VOA's Marissa Melton has more.
Democratic Congressman John Lewis, an icon in the fight for civil rights, announced Sunday he has stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Lewis said in a statement that he has been in some kind of fight for freedom, equality, basic human rights for his entire life, but never faced a battle quite like this one. He vowed to combat the illness and added that his doctors tell him he has a fighting chance. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi tweeted that generations of Americans have Lewis in their thoughts and prayers. She said she knows he will be well. The 79-year-old Lewis is best known as a tireless fighter for civil rights. He marched with Martin Luther King Jr. in the early 1960s and stood up to police brutality as well as aggression by everyday citizens. He has served in the U.S. House of Representatives since 1986. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Wounded victims of a Somali truck bomb attack. have been airlifted to Turkey. An Ethiopian hero is working to give girls back their dignity. Yemeni women with disabilities seek inclusion through wheelchair basketball. And melting glaciers threaten dramatic water level rise. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, after fits and starts, the past year saw the collapse of the Islamic State terror group's self-declared caliphate, the last scrap of IS-controlled territory in Syria, finally succumbing to U.S.-backed forces in March. U.S. Special Forces struck another blow in October, finding and killing IS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, only as VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden reports. IS seems to have been able to withstand the heavy blows, starting already to reassert itself across the globe.
Even before 2019 began, Islamic State was on the run, no longer able to rule territory in Iraq. There were some who said the terror group's time had come to an end.
I've been president for almost 2 years, and we've really stepped it up, and we have won against ISIS.
It was a claim U.S. President Donald Trump would make again and again.
We just took over, you kept hearing it was 90%, 92%, the caliphate in Syria. Now it's 100%. We just took over, 100% caliphate.
The claims at times disputed by U.S.-backed forces leading the charge against Islamic State's last enclave in Syria. Then on March 23rd, the Islamic State's self-declared caliphate fell for good. Only it quickly became clear the fight was not over. Islamic State fighters, as many as 18,000 of them, still roamed ungoverned spaces in Syria and Iraq. While thousands of captured fighters and tens of thousands of their relatives languished in makeshift prisons and displaced persons camps. In April, Islamic State showed signs of life, claiming responsibility for the Easter Sunday attack in Sri Lanka that killed at least 250 people and wounded scores more.
Alhamdulillah, salatu wassalam.
There was also word from its reclusive leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, urging followers not to lose faith in what he called a battle of attrition. Elsewhere, Islamic State affiliates flourished, intelligence sources estimating as many as 5,000 flocked to the terror group's black banner in Afghanistan.
So they certainly have got a desire, and the propaganda would indicate that they want to conduct attacks outside of Afghanistan, thus far relatively limited.
At the same time, Islamic State media operatives launched a social media campaign highlighting its efforts from Africa to the Philippines. But in October, a potentially devastating blow.
Last night, the United States brought the world's number one terrorist leader to justice. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead.
U.S. Special Forces tracked Baghdadi to his Syrian hideout, killing him, while U.S.-backed forces killed his number two. Islamic State quickly responded, naming a new caliph, the still mysterious Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qurashi, while IS followers and affiliates around the world rallied.
The insurgency is alive and kicking in northwest Iraq, for sure, and to a lesser degree Syria.
Still, as the year ends, the U.S. and its allies struck two more blows against Islamic State, defeat in a key Afghan province, and near eradication on one of its favorite social media platforms.
For the time being, for as far as we know, IS is not present on the internet anymore, and we will see how fast, if ever, they will regain surface.
Still, in places like Africa, where attacks like one in Niger killed 71 soldiers, troops are gearing up, expecting the battle against Islamic State to rage on, with little end in sight. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
The Scientists are scrambling to understand why thousands of dead mussels are turning up in several rivers across the United States and Europe, including one of the world's biodiversity hotspots. Experts worry that the rapid decline of mussels in Appalachia's Clinch River may be a sign of a worldwide die-off of the important water cleaners. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
At the bottom of Tennessee's Clinch River, these mussels are struggling.
This is a pheasant shell, Actinonias pectorosa. This is the species that we've been the most concerned about with the die-off in the Clinch River.
Biologist Jordan Richard with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says the Clinch River is home to a remarkable 46 species of mussels and 133 species of fish. It's one of the most biodiverse regions in the world. Just 3 years ago, Richard says there were nearly 100,000 pheasant shell mussels living in this stretch of river alone.
Now, as of 2019, we have less than 14,000 pheasant shell that live in that same stretch.
Mussels filter everything from silt to bacteria to heavy metals out of the water. Each one can clean up around 40 liters each day, so losing them is bad news.
First and foremost, you'd lose that water filtering effect, and so you'd have cloudier, more turbid water. You'd be more prone to algae blooms.
That's a problem for everything downstream, including plants and fish, as well as city water supplies. No one knows what's killing the mussels. Disease is a leading suspect, but Richard says mussels are also coping with several environmental problems.
One of the first questions that comes up when we tell people we have dying mussels is, could this be caused by climate change? Is this due to pollution? And the answer is probably always somewhere in the middle. Even if we pinpoint a single specific pathogen or disease that is the reason that the pheasant shells are dying in the Clinch River right now, there's probably more to it than that.
Researchers in North Carolina, Ohio, Oregon, and parts of Europe are reporting mass mussel die-offs too. They worry that this could be the beginning of a worldwide collapse with consequences for entire ecosystems. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
You're listening to In International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Farawengi Mebwatu has been named 2019 CNN Hero of the Year. She's being recognized for producing a patented reusable menstrual pad for girls in her native Ethiopia, where menstruation can still be considered taboo. VOA's Salam Solomon has the story.
Farawengi Mebwatu remembers when she returned to her home village in northern Ethiopia and saw women forced to squat over holes in the ground. Without sanitary pads to use during their menstrual period, they were forced to take humiliating measures.
How is that possible? And they were telling me that they don't even use underwear. And that was the most turning point for me. I kind of felt, you know, the nerves going from head to my toes. And that's when I said, you know, I've got to do something. Why is this thing bothering me over and over again? So that was it.
The more she examined the problem, the bigger it appeared. Froweni learned 2 out of 5 girls were being forced to miss school during their periods, with many eventually dropping out. Grown women were resorting to using old cloth or grass as pads.
We're talking about always gender equality and all that stuff, but when the basic necessity of a young girl is not fulfilled, how is that possible? How is that possible? How is the country even going to be developed when 50% of your society, women, are compromised this way? It is crazy.
In 2009, Froini founded Mariam Saba Products Factory in Ethiopia's northern city of Mekele. The factory produces reusable pads that can last up to 18 months and cost 90% less than disposable pads. More than 150,000 free menstrual hygiene kits have been distributed with the help of a nonprofit group called Dignity Period. At schools receiving the pads, attendance among girls has gone up 24%, according to the organization. This month, Froini was selected as the CNN Hero of the Year and will receive $100,000 to support her work. She said the timing of the award seemed to affirm her decision years ago to move from the U.S. to Ethiopia with her three-year-old daughter in order to pursue this cause. Now, her daughter is 18 years old and going off to college.
You know, it was the moment of an amazing journey, and people thought that I was crying because of the whole event. But it's the whole timing issue was just, it must have been God's willing to happen the way it happened.
But her work is not done. She noted that there are 30 million women of reproductive age in Ethiopia, and the vast majority do not have access to affordable sanitary pads. Salim Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
The World Health Organization reports that investigations into potential health threats and the quick response by World Health Organization and partners to global emergencies has protected millions of the world's most vulnerable people this year from disease and death. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from World Health Organization headquarters in Geneva.
In 2019, the World Health Organization and partners have responded to 51 emergencies in more than 40 countries and territories and have investigated 440 potential health threats in 138 countries and territories. After the headlines evoking these emergencies have faded away, the work of helping the victims of man-made and natural disasters recover carries on out of the media spotlight. Executive Director of WHO Emergencies Program, Michael Ryan, says the unseen work of sustaining fragile health systems in conflicts and other emergencies does not stop.
In Bangladesh, we work with partners to address the health needs of nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees living in the crowded camps in Cox's Bazar. The mortality rate in this highly vulnerable population has remained at low levels. These crude death rates remain well below what is considered acceptable in this situation. And that's down to a lot of hard work by a lot of people.
Ryan says WHO and partners have provided health services to more than 10 million people in Yemen. He says over 1 million children have been protected from vaccine-preventable diseases and more than 100,000 have been treated for severe acute malnutrition.
In Uganda, Ebola transmission was prevented after cases crossed from DRC on two separate occasions, and the preparedness work that's been going on in surrounding countries. Uganda, with the support of the international community, spent $18 million on preparedness and stopped Ebola twice.
The World Health Organization estimates more than $1 billion will be spent to root out the deadly Ebola virus, which has been circulating in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo since August 2018. The latest number of reported cases stands at 3,366, including 2,227 deaths. Other emergencies to which WHO has responded over the past year include the cyclone in Mozambique, conflict emergencies in Syria and South Sudan, floods in Iran, an earthquake in Albania, and a deadly measles outbreak on the small Pacific island of Samoa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
I do my hair toss, check my nails. Baby, how you feeling?
Breakthrough singer rapper Lizzo has been named Entertainer of the Year by the Associated Press. Voted by entertainment staffers of the news cooperative, Lizzo dominated the pop, R&B, and rap charts in 2019 with songs like Truth Hurts and Good as Hell. And though she released her first album in 2013, she dropped her major label debut, 'Cause I Love You, this year. And the success has made her the leading nominee as well at the 2020 Grammy Awards, where she is up for 8 honors. Outside of music, Lizzo has won over fans for promoting body positivity and denouncing fat shaming. Her live performances have been revered. Lizzo also had a role in the film Hustlers, opposite Jennifer Lopez, Constance Wu, and Cardi B, and she voiced a character in the animated picture Ugly Dolls. Lizzo was also named Entertainer of the Year by Time magazine. Tequila, I've been saving for you. Boss up and change your life. You can have it all, no sacrifice. I know we did you wrong, we can make it right. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. President Donald Trump recently signed a bill passed by the United States Congress that creates and funds a service branch to assist in deterring conflict in space. Called the United States Space Force, the branch will be part of the U.S. Air Force, much the way the Marine Corps are part of the U.S. Navy. Over time, the Space Force will evolve to become a standalone branch of the armed services. Scott Pace is Executive Secretary of the National Space Council. He explained why space is now considered what the Pentagon calls a warfighting domain.
Some people say, are we going to militarize space? And the answer is space has really been a military domain since the Soviet Union launched Sputnik. They used a converted ICBM to do it. So space has been a realm of military activity really since the very beginning. It's been used for reconnaissance, it's been used for communications, it's used for navigation. What space has not been has been a warfighting domain. And what's become different in the last few years, ever since the 2007 anti-satellite test that China conducted, where they destroyed one of their own weather satellites, we've seen a rapid and steady growth in anti-satellite weapons by Russia and China. China and Russia have, of course, observed how dependent we are on space for our military activities, and therefore they've been building weapon systems to place those capabilities at risk.
Executive Secretary Pace explained that similar to U.S. nuclear strategy, deterrence of any kind of battle is the key goal in space. The Space Force, which will be responsible for organizing, training, and equipping military and civilian personnel, is vital to that deterrence. The Space Force, said Vice President Mike Pence, will be a vanguard to defending our nation, defending our freedom, and defending the rights of all freedom-loving nations in the vast expanses of space.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.